Hello, everyone, and welcome again to the Associate Affiliate Cricket Podcast. We've got the World 2020 summary of the major rounds that included Ireland in the women's draw and Netherlands in the men's today, as long as Africa Division 3 and some news. And to join me to go through this is my regular co-host, Andrew Nixon. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Russ. Hi, everybody.
Andrew, let's start with the women's World 2020 competition, which Ireland was involved in. They had a fairly difficult group that included Australia and New Zealand, and one of the surprise packets of the tournament was South Africa, as well as Pakistan. The first match was against New Zealand, and Susie Bates really took them to the cleaners, getting New Zealand to 171, and they never really looked like chasing it.
Yeah, in many cases, it was Ireland's lack of experience against this level of opponent that did them in this match. They did bat out their overs, but scored way too slowly. Obviously, they only managed 129 in their 20 overs, chasing 171. You're never going to win a match if you can only score that quickly. Cecilia Joyce batted reasonably well for scoring 39 from 28 balls, but aside from that, there's not really much to write home about for the Ireland performance in that first match.
And it was something of a similar story in the second match against Australia, Meg Lanning this time. I'm not sure if it's a T20 record, but I suspect it is. Scored 126 off 65 balls to get Australia to 191. And again, Ireland never really looked like getting there.
Yeah, superb innings from Meg Lanning, who outscored the Ireland side single-handedly. And again, Ireland batted out the 20 overs. They kept the wickets in hand, but nobody was actually able to kick on and get a decent score. Isabel Joyce and Claire Shillington both scored over 20, but again, nothing much else to talk about in that innings.
And something of a recurring theme, I think before the tournament thought that the batting was probably Ireland's weak point, and they're not scoring big scores, but the bowling seems to have really let them down as well, because South Africa scored 165, and in this case Ireland was bowled out with one ball to spare for 79.
Yeah, and they sort of lost their last seven wickets for just 12 runs. Quite a drastic batting collapse there. Only Waldron with 33 was the only player to really score any runs. As you say, all the balls went at more than a run a ball. You really need to have at least one bowler who can go at less than a run a ball in 2020 cricket. Just a pretty poor performance from Ireland against South Africa.
And the final match of the group stage was against Pakistan, who they had beaten recently. Pakistan made 119, which, given that they managed to score in excess of that against Australia and quite close to that against New Zealand, they probably would have thought they could chase that down, but unfortunately they fell 14 runs short.
Yeah, I think we both said that this was a match for Ireland to target for a win in this tournament, and again, unfortunately, not to be, and lost some wickets quite quickly towards the end of their innings. They went from 77 for 3 to 88 for 8 inside less than 3 overs. At 77 for 3 with about 5 overs to go, you'd probably back them to chase 120. But again, they lost wickets quickly and bowled out for 105. Very disappointing all around for Ireland.
And finally, they had to play the 9th-10th playoff. It didn't mean anything, I don't think, although we never really know with the ICC, in the sense that it would get qualification in the next tournament. But again, having bowled reasonably well to keep Bangladesh to 106, they were bowled out for 89 in the chase.
Yeah, I think it's the bottom three in the tournament who have to qualify for the next one. Interesting that they're using the results of this tournament for qualification for the next one, as opposed to the men's tournament where they're going to be using the ICC rankings, which, as we have discussed numerous times in this podcast, are rather easily manipulated, if you like. Again, after restricting Bangladesh to 106, they would have hoped to have been able to chase that, but sort of this time they lost wickets early. They were sort of 14 for 3 inside 5 overs, and after a start like that, it's always going to be hard to recover, and sure enough, it proved to be so.
Should mention that Lucio Riley bowled very well in this match, taking 3 for 15, but a young up-and-coming player, very young.
Yeah, I think by far the youngest player in the tournament, perhaps even I think the second youngest player ever to play international cricket, either men's or women's. So maybe somebody to look at for the future. But you know, in general, a very disappointing performance by Ireland in this tournament. They would hope to have come away with maybe one win, certainly against either Pakistan or Bangladesh, and they were unable to. And you know, they'll still back themselves to qualify for the 2016 tournament, but a lot of work to be done if they're going to be successful in that.
Moving on to the men's side, obviously we spoke about in our last podcast that the Netherlands were the associate team that got through in that very interesting final day. It's hard to say what went wrong in the first match, but it couldn't have gone much worse. The bowled out for 39 against Sri Lanka.
Yeah, it sort of started badly with Myberg being dismissed for a duck within the first three balls, and you know, sort of went badly from there. Tom Cooper, the only batsman to get double figures, scoring 16. Everybody else just clattered out, really. Netherlands, obviously, not used to playing against the type of bowling that Sri Lanka have. As a lot of teams are, we saw later in the tournament that New Zealand could only score 60 against Sri Lanka, and that was only due to Kane Williamson scoring 42. So, you know, if even New Zealand are struggling against that sort of bowling, then a team like the Netherlands, who aren't seeing this sort of bowling on a regular basis, are always going to struggle. Very poor start, and I think Peter Boren said as much in the post-match interviews and press conference that he was quite embarrassed and even felt the need to apologise to the other associate members.
They came back really strongly, though, in the second match that they played against South Africa, and I'm sure they're still kicking themselves that they couldn't pull off a win here, because having got South Africa to 145 for 9 and then chasing Jamil took 5 for 19 off his 4 overs, an extremely impressive spell of slow medium bowling. They should have won from where they were. They were 3 for 97 with almost 10 overs to play.
Yeah, and then 116 for 4 with 7 overs to play. You'd expect to chase 145 from there, but unfortunately it wasn't to be. Stefan Myberg batted well, we should say, scored 51 from just 28 balls, quite superb innings from him, but you know, the second highest score was 16 by Tom Cooper, and you know, had they had just one other player go on and make a decent score, you know, sort of around 30, then you know, they would have won this game, and they'd be very frustrated not to have done so. And it was a good recovery after that disappointing performance against Sri Lanka, and as you say, Jamil's taking 5 for 19. Absolutely superb performance by him.
The third matches, they batted first this time. They scored 151 against New Zealand. Some good late hitting from Boren and Cooper, who scored 49-40 respectively. But they didn't defend it, even though they might have felt that they were a fairly good chance.
Yeah, they sort of came up against Brendan McCullum in fine form. He scored 65 from 45 balls. I think he was dropped quite early in his innings, and I think it was a catch that was sort of parried over for a six, and had that catch stuck, then you know, maybe you know, the match could have been closer than it otherwise was. You know, New Zealand did take 19 overs to chase the run, so you know, Netherlands didn't bowl terribly by any means. But again, a much improved performance from the Sri Lanka match. But as you say, they'll be disappointed not to have won.
I want to mention the catching, because we mentioned on the last podcast that some of the associate catching was very poor. But actually, it's not been any worse than some of the four members on reflection, because they've also been fairly ordinary for a lot of this tournament.
Yes, from what I've seen, fielding has been an issue for nearly every team. Some of the runouts we've seen have been impressive, but the catching in general has been quite poor. It's not what you expect to see at the highest level of 2020 cricket.
Yeah, and there is due, particularly the night matches. But as you say, it should be better, and maybe the associates aren't quite as far behind as we thought, despite it all.
Yeah.
Going on to the last match, this was a match that people... It's not clear exactly why everyone thought the Netherlands should beat England. I know England's struggling a little bit, and they've beaten them before, but England really should still be the favourites going into this match. But actually, they never really looked like they were in it, England, and they were basically flogged.
Yeah, as I said on Twitter, had an associate played like this against a full member, people would be saying that the associate shouldn't be playing at this level and all that sort of stuff. And yeah, in terms of your wins by associates against full members in World Cups and World 2020s, is probably ranks up there with the best. You know, the Netherlands were just by far the better team. You know, Berasi scored 48, Meiberg scored 39, so Broad took a couple of wickets towards the end just to slow down the run scoring a bit. But in reply, you know, you look at that scorecard and only three batsmen in double figures, Hales, Papara and Jordan. Logan van Beek, who previously in the tournament had taken just two wickets and conceded 104 runs, they made him look like one of the best bowlers in the tournament. He took 3 for 9 from just two overs. As I joked on Twitter, it's quite disgraceful to see players racking up their statistics against weaker teams.
Yeah, Bakari also bowled particularly well. Took 3 for 12, and yeah, it's quite extraordinary performance by England, and the interviews after were interesting as well. Broad put it down to complacency, which is interesting for a team that's already been eliminated from the tournament to be complacent about potentially coming last. They were only a couple of decimal points away from being last, England, in the group. But also, Peter Boren made a good point that England were defeated by the team that had recently come 7th in the global qualifier and then is basically ranked 19th in the world.
Yeah, I think that was a very good point by Peter Boren, and it just shows the depth in associate cricket. And I think if you give associates more matches against full members, you're going to see these sort of things more often. When it's just one-off matches, you know, it's hard to get any sort of idea of the real strength of associate cricket. And you know, we both know that strength is there, and I think, you know, we need more matches between associates and full members, but unfortunately, we're not sure about what the Netherlands are going to get in terms of matches against full members.
Yeah, the Netherlands, an interesting case. People who don't follow associate cricket closely, people who are still talking about Ryan Tendulkar not being in the side, seemingly kind of look at the Netherlands and think of the performances in the 2011 World Cup and that they are one of the strongest associates. But as we've noted a second ago, they're ranked 19th. They're in World Cricket League Division 2. And also in terms of development, they probably aren't doing as well as a lot of the teams around them either.
No. We spoke on the last episode as well about the lack of homegrown, sort of Dutch-born and trained talent coming through into the team. It is there at sort of youth level, but it's sort of disappearing as they get to senior level, where they are becoming increasingly reliant on the sort of Australian and New Zealand and South African-based players. and obviously going down to a World League Division 2 and missing out on the top tier of high performance funding, it's going to be even harder for them to develop. They still have access to the TAP funding for this year and next year, I think. But once that runs out, it's going to be hard to see where the money is going to be coming from, especially if they're not, you know, playing in a World Cup or getting regular matches against full members, which may attract sponsors.
Yeah, and I want to talk about the development figures, so at least the ICC ones, because a decade ago they were basically level with Scotland in terms of the numbers. It was a few thousand cricketers at senior and junior level. Since then, Scotland's moved from that to 10,000, 5,000 senior and 5,000 junior cricketers, and the Netherlands have added a couple hundred at each. Now, obviously, ICC figures aren't always perfectly accurate, but that's indicative to me that it's been a real lost decade for the Netherlands, and that's going to, again, haunt them, because the reason that these teams are coming up behind them is because they have done that groundwork at the development level to get players into their league cricket.
Yeah, and you're seeing less Dutch players getting involved in county cricket as well, which I think shows just how down the pecking order Dutch produced players are. A decade ago, you had Bas Zuiderink was playing for Sussex, and Daan van Bunger had signed a contract for Middlesex, wasn't successful. And before that, you had Lefebvre, Andre van Troost, and a couple of other players as well. And that's not happening anymore. Alexis Cavesi obviously is almost a once in a generation talent who has started playing county cricket, but without much success in the last couple of years. You can't look at any of the other sort of Dutch produced players and say that they fit well in county cricket, and that's definitely a failure of the Dutch development program. And it's hard to see where they go from here. You'd hope that they'd now use the little ICC funding they now get to try and strengthen their youth programs. They have the a schools project that they do with the bilingual schools in the Netherlands, the schools that teach in both English and Dutch. Whether that can start producing something remains to be seen. A problem with a lot of schools projects is trying to actually then integrate those players into club cricket and to have them come through and play for the clubs rather than the schools, and then into the Dutch youth national teams. So if they can do that, then they might have a chance. If not, it's not looking good.
Yeah, and I guess the last point to make is that there are a lot of nations in Europe as well who are coming up behind them. Italy's working quite hard on their development, Germany as well, and France. So they can't afford to stay still for another 10 years, because they'll certainly be down the pecking order, probably in the same sense that Denmark has drifted backwards.
They need to take lessons in what's happened to Denmark, and whatever Denmark's done, try and do the opposite, I think.
Andrew, before we sign off on the World 2020, opinions on the tournament? Final thoughts?
Yeah, I think overall it's been a successful tournament. We are recording this before the final takes place, so there's still time for the ICC to make an almighty cock-up, as they have done at World Cups in the past. So far, it's been a pretty successful tournament. Good performance by the associates. It's the first tournament where three associates have beaten four members, which is sort of something for associate cricket to be proud of. But let's not have it in this format again. Let's move to a four groups of four, a proper 16-team World Cup. You look at the raw win-loss records of, say, England and Australia, and despite them having the second worst win-loss record, they've essentially both finished within the top eight of the tournament. And if that doesn't show just what a silly format it is, nothing will. And just to perhaps show where ICC priorities lie, people will have noticed that in the Super 10 stage, the ICC were using the zing bales and stumps, the ones that light up when the wicket is broken. A set of those, so six stumps, four bales, costs $40,000. 50 ICC members get less than that a year in annual funding. So just to show where the ICC's priorities lie, Daryl Cullinan gave an interview on Crick Info where he talked about the ICC wasting money on associates. Well, if you know, 30,000 or 10,000 that some associate and affiliates get is wasting money, what is spending 40,000 on a set of stumps?
Yeah, and I think we pointed out in the last podcast, but it should be pointed out again that the women's tournament was not streamed even. It was not on television until the semi-final stage, so we didn't see any of the Irish matches, which is extremely disappointing for a world tournament, and the women's cricket got such short shrift, especially when the point of having the women at the same time as the men is to try and promote the women's game at the same time as the men's tournament's on. To not actually show any of the group matches was fairly pathetic, and as I think I've said on this podcast again, the Tanzanian cricket managed to stream an African women's tournament last year, and if Tanzanian cricket can do it, then the ICC has absolutely no excuses, because really, it's really poor.
Yeah, and it doesn't need to be a full, you know, TV broadcast quality production. Just your sort of, you know, four or five camera production will do the job just nicely. That's what Kwipu TV have done in the past, and I don't see any reason why the ICC couldn't have done this for this women's tournament. Very disappointed.
Speaking of members who get very little funding, Andrew, there was another tournament on since we last spoke, which was the African Vision 3 2020. I think we said there were five teams playing, but it turned out there were four, which was Swaziland, Sierra Leone, Rwanda and Gambia. It was played in Benoni, near Johannesburg, in South Africa. For the first 2 days of this tournament, it gave the impression that Sierra Leone and Rwanda were the two teams to beat, and their final match was going to decide this tournament, but the final day was a bit of a mess after that.
Yeah, so the tournament started with, as you say, Sierra Leone and Rwanda looking like they were going to run away with it. On the opening day, Sierra Leone beat Swaziland by 64 runs. And then beat Rwanda by six wickets. We should mention Swaziland on that opening day put more than 200 against the Gambia, with Idris Patel scoring 113, excellent innings from him. And again on the second day, Sierra Leone and Rwanda were looking again. They were both on top. Sierra Leone did lose on the second day. They lost a match to Swaziland, which is a little bit of a surprise. But going into the opening morning, it looked like the result of the Sierra Leone-Rwanda game that morning would basically decide the tournament. Sierra Leone beat Rwanda by 16 runs. Swaziland again put 200 past the Gambia. This time, Eric Sauerman scored a century. And then, in the afternoon, something quite unusual happened. You know, Swaziland beat Rwanda by 34 runs, scored 132, then bowled them out for just 98. And then Gambia, who at that point hadn't even won a game, somehow managed to beat Sierra Leone. They were bowled out for 126, and Sierra Leone could only manage 117 for 9 from their 9 overs. And the net run rate calculations showed that Swaziland we're on top, and they get promoted to Division 2. A big surprise after the first 2.5 days of play, where it looked like it was between Sierra Leone and Rwanda.
Yeah, amazing turnaround by Gambia, just to give a sense of how well they played to that point. Of the six games, they'd lost 55 wickets, so they were almost bowled out every single time, and their net run rate, even after the win, was minus 2.9, which means they're basically going at 3 runs per over worse than the other teams across the tournament. And yet somehow they pulled off an upset, which was enormous in the context.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're well played the Gambia, and definitely well played Swaziland.
Joining me today is James Coyne, the assistant editor of the Wisden Almanac and the Cricket Round the World section, to talk about this year's edition, both Cricket Round the World and a few other parts. Welcome, James.
Hello, Russ. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here. But before we get to this year's edition, Cricket Round the World had a milestone of sorts last year, getting 20 years in Wisden, and released an anthology, Elks Stop Play. Do you want to tell us a bit about that and the philosophy behind the selections that were made for that piece?
Yeah, it was put together by Charlie Connolly, who's a travel writer from England, and he, like many of us, has sort of fallen in love with cricket in non-traditional countries, should we say? And I think he's written a foreword and an introduction to it where he explains that he saw cricket in Holland at a young age, and that sort of alerted him to the idea that cricket was going on outside the 10 or the however many test playing nations there were at the time, 7 or 8, I imagine. And I think he really has tried to alert people to the most sort of most exciting and unusual stories around the world. So I mean, there's some real crackers in there from East Timor and Kiribati and Panama, and it really is he's tried to go for as broad a selection as possible. He hasn't chosen anything from Afghanistan, for instance, which may surprise you, but I think in his eyes they've probably moved beyond that sort of categorisation in a way.
Yeah, in the introduction, Michael Palin, who did that, mentioned that the Cricket Around the World section charts every detail cricket's global advance. Is that something you also see has been the philosophy behind Cricket Around the World, that you're there to chart the development of the game?
We are, absolutely. I mean, myself and Timothy Abraham, who's another journalist, we've been putting together Cricket Around the World for 3 or 4 years, and we really have tried to do that. Obviously, we're always looking for exciting stories and quirky instances, but we... Both of us are very, very passionate about the game becoming a global game, truly global game. And so we do look for, we're always on the lookout for upturns in fortunes for countries. I mean, Thailand, for instance, this year, their women's team have done remarkably well. So that was one that we thought, right, we must get Thailand in this year. So that's something we're always trying to do. So aside from telling the stories of the more unusual stories, we're always trying to chart the true development progress of these upcoming nations.
And one of the interesting parts of the book that I noticed was that it actually tracks back on a number of these old stories to see what's happened since then. Is that globalisation really apparent when you track back on those stories, or is it there's some forward and quite a lot of backwards steps as well?
Yeah, inevitably that's the case. Some of the correspondents would have written with over-egged the pudding sometimes, as Matthew Engel put it once, and others have been probably more accurate. So I mean, there's the odd occasion where sadly things haven't worked out. Like we had a very nice story a couple of years ago from Hungary about the name of a ground which I can't even pronounce, but it was in a town called Isa Kintjorgi, I think, and it was a ground built in an old quarry. It was a lovely story, and unfortunately it just fell through lack of funding, and that's something that's really, that's a story that all of us involved with associate and affiliate cricket will appreciate, because quite often the funding just isn't there. But so that's an example of one where it didn't work out, but then there's others where, the game has gone on in leaps and bounds since a very early entry was written from Nepal or something like that. So, that naturally there are positive stories and stories where the game has just stagnated a little.
And have you found that there's been any waning of optimism over the past 20 years as well? Obviously, at the beginning point, there was a sense that no one really knew about this, but obviously now we know that development has worked in some places and not in others.
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is that, you know, when Matthew Engel brought in cricket around the world, I think it was 1993, there weren't really many people writing about the game in non-traditional countries. There wasn't really that going on very much. So it really was a novel thing, as you say. And there were all sorts of stories to be mined and stories to be told that hadn't been told before, certainly in traditional media anyway. Now, it does get harder year on year in many ways to find stories, but they are there. And countries, you know, wax and wane. And, there are possibly regions that were slightly undertold in the 1990s, like the Pacific Islands, and you know, there's wonderful stories of the traditional cricket being played in throughout Polynesia. You know, there's a wonderful story from New Caledonia a couple of years ago about women's cricket, where women's cricket is actually far more popular than men's cricket, it seems to me. So these stories are always there. You just have to look for them, and also, you know, since the late 1990s and early 2000s, with the real flow of migrants to different parts of the globe, and the opening up of countries in the former Soviet Union, there's new cricket popping up all the time in places like Tajikistan or Uzbekistan, which really was under the radar for a while, but now people are starting to really try and expand the game there.
The other thing I'd like to ask about this, what's particularly the philosophy behind how you put the cricket around the world together, is the titles. One of those interesting parts that it's Elk Stop Play, it gives that sense of kind of obscurity. And one of the things we aim on this podcast is obviously to push cricket at being that it's actually played seriously in all of these places. So how do you actually strike the balance between having these interesting pieces and kind of travel stories against events and development issues, which obviously is our focus here?
Yeah, it's the perennial balance that we have to strike. You know, it's there's no doubt that in some of the countries that we're covering, you know, the cricket is of a pretty good standard. Places like Germany, places like Namibia. I mean, that's the high end of obviously Namibia much better than Germany, but that's the high end of around the world, as it were, where we're trying to talk about pushing the game onto the next level. So yes, it's constantly a balance to strike. I mean, sometimes the story is just too good to miss, and you have to. Quite often, correspondents write in, and it's a bit, you know, they write very very long stories, and sometimes you have to rejig the, you know, to tinker around with them to try and alert people to the great hook in the story. But what we're also determined to do is to tell the story of how cricket really is developing as well. So it's sometimes a matter of just framing the story slightly, to be honest, because quite often there's great little nuggets involved in the story, but it's just bringing it to the fore, and then you can go into the development of the game after that. I mean, we have a long story from Russia this year where we talk about there's a great line that, you know, Cricket Russia have actually sold the licensing rights of their Russian players to Don Bradman Cricket 14 computer game. You know, that's something that you just have to alert people to. It's just a great nugget. You can't go past that. But at the same time, we're trying to tell the story about how they hired a baseball coach to coach their fielders. So it's a constant balance we're trying to strike.
I want to ask about that. One of the things I noticed reading through it is that there's, I feel, a real mastery of that kind of offhand comment where you read it and you think, well, there's an awful lot more to this story, but it's really just a single line. You obviously have a lot of space issues to deal with within the Cricket Around the World section.
Yeah, we're trying to, broadly speaking, include maybe 15 or 16, sometimes more, stories from around the world, and space is an issue, of course. You know, to countries like the USA, where obviously we have long-standing administrative problems, and where a lot of money's been ploughed into the game, we're perhaps willing to give slightly more space. But yeah, you're right. That sort of throwaway offhand comment is quite often does the job. You know, sometimes you don't need always a long-winded explanation. Sometimes that comment is simply enough, and then people can go and look themselves at more of a story. It's just judging what to do in that circumstance, whether to go into more detail or whether to just let people read it and work out for themselves sometimes.
And I guess, where do you see the audience for this? Obviously, it's wisdom readers generally rather than people who have a fairly strong interest in cricket in these more obscure places. So you've obviously, when you do those offhand comments, they may not necessarily register that, you know, there's actually quite a big story there.
Yeah, to be honest, I think I'm trying to target people who are interested in global cricket, because I think there's a growing recognition that the game, a growing feeling certainly over the last few years, the game is turning in on itself a little bit at the highest levels of the ICC, and I think part of our job is to tell people that there is cricket everywhere. Almost everywhere, anyway. We haven't found any in Albania yet. But to be honest, I'm trying to target people who have a genuine interest in global cricket, rather than people who are just skimming through the section and looking for a funny line. I mean, what we have to do is tell the story of why cricket is different in different parts of the globe, and sometimes that involves an offhand comment, quirky story, but at the same time, we're trying to tell people. We have a missionary statement in this section to try and explain to people that the game is played everywhere and that we have to try and grow it.
So, moving on to this year's edition, what pieces in particular should our listeners be looking forward to?
Well, I mean, one thing I have noticed in the last couple of years is that we're having a lot more stories of women's cricket in more traditional countries. No, that's no surprise when you look at the expansion of the game everywhere, really, and what's happening even in the World 2020. I mean, as I mentioned before, Thailand, who almost qualified, they were one game away from qualifying for the World 2020, or one game away from playing a playoff game, I should say. So, I mean, that's a lovely story from Richard Lockwood in Thailand. He tells a story of a couple of Thai women's players who've been playing in Sri Lankan women's cricket, and they've also been the Cricket Association of Thailand have also been going into some of the hill tribes from remote villages in northern Thailand to try and find some young players. So I think in Thailand at the moment there's a solid base of the game in expat communities, and I think they're starting to find young Thai kids that can play the game, and all the Thai women's team are Thai, essentially. So that's a great story there. And then there's other little snippets from Italy where they think they've quadrupled the playing quadrupling female cricket numbers over the last 2 years, which is a great story. And also we have a nice little sort of first person piece from Iran, from Monir Habibi, who won Volunteer of the Year at the ICC Development Awards last year. And she tells a story of how women in Iran get into cricket and why it's actually, you know, relatively popular amongst women in Tehran especially. So I would say this year that's the element that I'm really proud of this year. But aside from that, we have some quite serious news stories. We have a report from Nauru, where there's a detention centre for asylum seekers trying to get to Australia. And there's a story of cricket from inside the detention centre. And a gentleman called Mark Isaacs, who's a case manager for asylum seekers in Sydney, he spent sort of 9 months trying to spread cricket and trying to give some of these guys from Afghanistan, Pakistan, Sri Lanka a chance to play some cricket. So that's a rather unusual example of a cricket around the world story, but I thought it was one that should be told. It's a real mix this year, and I'm quite proud that we managed to strike that balance.
I certainly back you up on the women's stories. I thought it was a very impressive mix of women's cricket this year. I want to ask about the kind of, Wisden obviously has a long-standing history as being a repository for results, and one of the interesting parts of reporting on Associate Cricket is that it's actually quite difficult to find results, particularly in certain regions. How do you deal with this, and how do you deal with what level of kind of how obscure games have to be before you will mention them?
Quite often, the more obscure, the better, I think. I mean, as you say, I think a lot of us have struggled to find reliable results from some of the regions. I mean, Africa is a region where we're desperate to try and find some stories from there. And we had a very lovely story from Liberia last year. So, I mean, it quite often, it's not a barrier for us, really, because behind those results, there's almost guaranteed to be a great story behind how cricket has got to some of the more struggling affiliates. Rwanda, for instance, if you scrape beneath the surface there, there's a very interesting news story there about the stadium they're building and how the game started in the school where there was the massacre during the Civil War. So I think quite often, I don't think we're put off by that, really, because I think if you look hard enough, there's stories there.
I know the China piece talks about Olympic status, which was something that had come up this year.
Yeah, so yeah, as we know, it actually wasn't that widely reported from what I could see, but I think it was in June or July at an ICC meeting. The four members decided not to apply for Olympic status, and as many of us in the associate and affiliates community, we're all too aware that the funding model would change again if 2020 did become an Olympic sport. And I think certainly in China, which is, you know, an Olympic mad nation, sees many things in sport through the prism of gold, silver and bronze. It's in places like China where that decision may have the most effect. And in our China entry this year, our correspondent John Newton, who's heavily involved in Shanghai cricket, he leads off on that and explains that, you know, people are saying in Hong Kong and China that getting 2020 into the Olympics is really what is really needs to happen if the game is truly spread there. And obviously that's a setback for many countries, I think. And we know from documents seen from the ICC that they decided in the end that the opportunity cost was to the ICC was too much to bear, really, in order to go into the Olympics. And that I think for many of us involved in reporting on associate and affiliate cricket, I think it sticks in the craw a little, to be honest. I don't know how you feel about that, but certainly I feel that way.
It's certainly something we've brought up on this show before. Yes. Joseph, is there anything else you wanted to mention about cricket around the world this year?
What I would say is my personal favourite is a story from Japan, which is actually from 1863, where Royal Navy officers were rowed ashore to play the first cricket game in Japan, and we reported on that this year because it's the 150th anniversary of the first ever game in Japan. And the real interesting thing about that game was that the Royal Marines, there were Royal Marines ringed around the ground to protect the players, and that many of the players actually carried weapons onto the field. So that's an example of a cricket around the world story which we've indulged a little, and it's not a development story as such, although we go later on we talk about development in Japan and the prospects for cricket in Japan, but in the present day, but that's an example where we've sort of gone into history and tried to alert people to just a great story, really.
And actually, history is something, obviously, because it is relatively new still, only 20 years out of Wisden's significantly longer history. Is that something that you'll look at in the future, of talking about the history of some of these countries?
Yeah, I mean, well, those stories are there. You know, if you go back and look in Barclay's World of Cricket, Roy Morgan's book on cricket, the Encyclopedia of World Cricket. You know, those stories are there. And quite often they haven't been fleshed out completely, or they haven't been told. It's something that I'm certainly keen to do. As always, space is an issue because these stories require a lot of explanation. You know, this Japan story, we have to explain why why the Navy was bombarding Kagoshima in 1863 or 1864. So quite often it requires explanation, but I think quite often these stories are very rewarding. Yeah, I mean, it's something that certainly I'll be looking to do in the future. I mean, we also do something similar in Myanmar this year, where we mention that the last king of Burma, Tibor, was a I have no idea if I've just pronounced his name correctly or not, but that he fell under the spell of cricket. So it's something that I'm certainly keen to do in the future.
The end of last year obviously saw some really big changes within the ICC, and those changes obviously filter then down to all of the associated affiliate nations as well. So what has Wisden put together on obviously the biggest story in cricket at the moment?
Yeah, well, we have, I'd like to think that we, obviously in cricket around the world, we sort of will be dealing with these issues over the next few years and the knock-on effect of what these changes will mean. In terms of Wisden 2014, which comes out on April the 10th, we have an article by Gideon Haig, who obviously many people think probably knows more than anybody about the ICC and the machinations of this. His piece is titled "The Great Carve-Up of World Cricket." And straight away, he's invoked an analogy between Churchill, Stalin, and Roosevelt, General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler. Clark, Edwards, and Srinivasan. So, it's he's not really held back there. He's written a very, very strong but balanced piece on what's gone on there. And we've also accompanied that with a piece by Giles Clark, who has made his feelings known about the prospects for global development and where it should go from now on. And he's written a piece really spelling out the financial implications for this, and we thought it was for the editor Lawrence Booth, and we thought it was important that we give him a say, really, that we can balance out the two pieces and lead people to make up their own minds. And Lawrence himself has got he's led off his notes by the editor leads off on the ICC governance overall. So we've covered it quite strongly this year.
Obviously, one of the issues for Wisden is that as a record of happenings that's kind of almost carved in stone, how do you deal with a story like this that's actually moving really quickly? It's actually something else that came up in the USA piece.
Yeah, you're more right than you know. It's it's as you say, it's a moving piece. You know, the true implications of what's happening were not truly known, really. So it is very difficult for us. You know, we have one big deadline, and we have to make sure that we get things as accurate as we can by that deadline. We were slightly fortunate with this that it all started to happen with a few weeks to go before we had to deliver the book to the printers. So we were able, I think, to give it the coverage it deserves. Sometimes you're beholden to the public, to the deadline, but I think this time we were actually able to lead off on it and do the story justice.
And within the philosophy of Wisden, many of these issues have very deep origins. You can actually, I quite enjoy reading old editors' notes, because some of them even 100 years ago seem to pull up the same issues with test championships and things like that. What role do you see Wisden having in terms of promoting good governance, and can it make a difference to that?
We hope so. I mean, maybe that's... I think... Yeah, when the game was run out of laws, you could argue that we possibly had slightly greater influence. That's my personal opinion. Cricket has changed since those days. Does it have an influence? I know that Giles Clark, you know, looks very, very carefully to see what Wisden says. Whether it influences the thinking, you'd have to ask him. But I think what our editors have always tried to stress in the notes, I mean, they always have slightly different takes on what's best for the game, but I do think that they, broadly speaking, we want the governance of the game to be more secure and really to back up what Eastern Marnie said in many ways, to move into into the realms of best practice and to become a true governing body. I think that's what, I mean, that's the number one thing that Lawrence stresses in his opening notes. The game should become a governing body.
That's all the questions I have, James. Is there anything else you wanted to add about this year?
I should add that we, in Wisdom 2012, we had a long piece by Gideon Haig about, called Fear and Loathing in Dubai, about ICC governance and about the Harun Lawgat's attempt to implement or to bring up the Wolf Review and to try and make some of those changes. He told the story of that. And that was one of those examples in Wisdom where we allowed a correspondent a really long piece. We occasionally do that, where someone is given, you know, 12, 14 pages to really flesh out the topic, and it's a true essay in a way. And that was a very long and important piece for us. I think we felt that story hadn't really been told, the recent history of the ICC. I would suggest anyone who's interested in governance, governance issues, to go and seek out that article in Wisdom 2012.
Thanks for coming on then, James. We should mention that obviously it's for sale on April the 10th, as well as an e-book, I believe, that will include the Cricket Around the World section and the governance pieces.
It will, yes. We have the Shorter Wisdom is sort of a distillation of all the comment section, all the major international, all the major England reports, and it does include Cricket Around the World as well. It's wisdom without the statty stuff, really. And there's a lot in there. And that's available on the same day. That should be coming out also on April the 10th. And I believe that's $12.99, I believe. So yeah, we have, Wisdom is now available both in print and as an e-book as well, which is really good news.
Andrew, there's a few bits of news that have come out. Scotland and the Netherlands have announced that they've got a Pro Series, the North Sea Pro Series, running this year. It will be a 50-over and a 20-over competition between four teams, played home and away on Sundays and Mondays.
Yeah, we sort of heard rumours of this tournament last year. Ireland obviously not involved in the end. Scotland and Netherlands did play a couple of trial games between their sides last year. And obviously they're now having a proper league, which is supported by the ICC TAP funding, Targeted Assistance Performance Programme. But as we said earlier, that's only going to be in place now for another 2 years. And the talk is that the ICC reforms will see that fund scrapped. Obviously it can help teams. You saw, the West Indies did so well in the World 2020 after, you know, getting TAP funding last time. So obviously it can help. I am, of course, being sarcastic there. In the absence of the Netherlands and Scotland taking part in English county cricket, this will give another level of play between club cricket and international cricket that is often missing in associate and affiliate countries. And hopefully it'll be successful.
Yeah, hopefully the finances make sense so they can continue, and after the TAP funding finishes, Scotland will be, if the ICC reforms go through as they're expected to, will be significantly better endowed with money than than the Netherlands will be, which may make for an interesting negotiation between the two if they want to continue it.
Yeah, and it'd be interesting to see whether there's any sort of expansion of this as well, whether the Irish provincial sides do eventually join it, so we've got a European league, or sort of get teams in maybe the Channel Islands or some other European teams like in Denmark or Italy or wherever. It's something that's been talked about for a long while, a sort of European league on the lines of the Rugby Union, what used to be the Celtic League. I think it's called the Pro 12 or something now. I don't follow rugby unions, I can't quite remember. But yeah, a good start, and hopefully it'll continue for a few years, even after the TAP funding runs out. Perhaps after a couple of years, if it's successful, they can start looking for corporate sponsorship, which will obviously help keep the tournament alive and keep it professional.
Yeah, the professionalism is probably obviously the first thing to go if they do run out of money. But having it on more or less the weekend would obviously help in that sense if they have to cut that out.
Yeah, they're playing it on Sunday and Monday, which is a little bit of a surprise. There will be some public holidays in sort of late May, early June on Mondays, but in general, you know, maybe Saturday and Sunday would be better, but obviously, you know, you need to keep the clubs happy, and I think the clubs mostly in Scotland certainly play on Saturdays. I think in the Netherlands they mostly play on Sundays, but yeah, you've got to keep the clubs happy. Whether it remains on Sunday and Monday in the future, it remains to be seen. I'd probably prefer it to be played on Saturday and Sunday, but obviously they've got reasons for having it Sunday and Monday. But yeah, it should help keeping, you know, have it. And I think they're going to fly, say, both Dutch teams over to Scotland and then both Scottish teams over to the Netherlands and so on and so forth, which should help keep down on costs. But you know, all in all, it's good to see this this tournament start.
We have the news in the UAE of sorts as well. Obviously, the UAE will be hosting the first 20 matches of the IPL shortly because of the election in India, which is good for cricket there, that they're continuing to get some high-profile matches. This has also led to them looking to host the World Cup in 2027, which is an interesting call.
Yeah, I think you had this sort of come out a week later than it did. People would have assumed it was an April Fool's joke, but obviously it isn't. 2027, obviously a long way away. But the UAE is probably the associate that is best placed to host a major ICC tournament. Obviously, they've hosted a number of World 2020 qualifiers. They've hosted the Under-19 World Cup just this year, and as you say, they're now hosting the IPL, and they've hosted, you know, Pakistan's home games for a number of years now. And what will happen in terms of qualification for that World Cup would be interesting. Obviously, we don't know whether it will remain a 10-team tournament as it's planned to by 2027, and whether the UAE as host would get automatic entry, you know, is a given in almost all sports that if you're hosting a tournament, you get automatic qualification to the tournament. You know, in many sports, the hosts are the only team to get automatic qualification. And it's so it'd be interesting to see what happens with the UAE and that then, but obviously it's a long way away and it's by no means certain. The ICC seem determined to allocate all major events to India, Australia and England.
Yeah, I think that being so far away, it means it's very almost impossible to kind of judge what the landscape will be like there. The ICC is changing by the day in that sense. If it stayed the way it is now, then it's almost certainly not going to happen. It would almost certainly go to one of the big three because that's how they've been divvying it up. There's an outside chance there won't be a World Cup in 2027, depending on what happens with 2020 cricket as well. One day is, but it's an interesting call, though, and it obviously shows that the benefits of having a good infrastructure, that they at least feel that they can do this job.
Yeah, and you know, even if it does happen, the fact that an associate is confident enough to even talk about hosting a World Cup is something to be quite pleased about.
It wouldn't be a podcast, Andrew, if we didn't have new news from Osaka. They're in the middle of a governance reform process. They are expected to vote on it relatively soon. It's been said that the leagues that will be allowed to vote on it will be those who were playing in 2012 and 2013, which is 15 leagues that are all associated very strongly with Western Dainty. Whether as a response to this or for other reasons, both Darren Beasley, the CEO, has resigned to head up Swimming West Australia, and Brian Walters, who had been the chairman of the Governance Review Committee, have both resigned from Osaka, which is probably an indication that however this reform process is going, it's not going to be in the direction the ICC wanted.
Yeah, it would certainly appear that way. Yet again, Gaston Deans, he seems to be staying in control. He's seen off another CEO. And, I think we've seen something like this coming for a while. And as you say, we do seem to talk about it an awful lot, USACA shenanigans. Was it on April Fool's Day, everybody's favourite comedy cricket administrator, Kenwyn Williams, put out what would otherwise have been a very convincing April Fool, a letter from the ICC suspending USACA. The trick was that it was the old USACA address on the top of the letter. But it can't be too long before the real letter comes suspending USACA. They certainly have, they've got two competing governing bodies now. As we discussed before, the American Cricket Federation has requested a review of the governance of US cricket, and it's hard to see anything other than at the ICC's annual meeting this summer, it's Northern Hemisphere summer, USACA at least being suspended, if not completely expelled from the ICC.
Yeah, I think Beasley obviously was an ICC choice for CEO, and Walters had been part of that process. So the ICC might have gone along with USACA doing what USACA does if they had their men there. I can't see that happening if they're the people that they've put their trust in have gone, that they will look at them now as an organisation that's doesn't do anything that the ICC has any interest in doing, takes the money and isn't properly run. And as you say, it would be extraordinary if they weren't suspended in June.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's all we have today. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, Russ.